Session number 9407, Richard White, part one.
Where were you born, Mr. White?
I was born in London, St. Giles Hospital.
Which year was that?
1909.
What did your father do for a living?
Well, my parents were both professional musicians at one time, and then, of course, there was a lot of unemployment among musicians in that era, and he did all sorts of things, my father. And then when I was five, six, we moved down to Dorset, where he became the manager of an estate there, which belonged to the Gribble family, liberal family that lived in London. And he managed that, and my sister, one of my sisters, of whom I had four, was the herds, became the herdswoman. She did the looking after pedigree Jersey cows and making the butter and this and that. And my father generally managed the whole thing. So I went to school in the village school. Until I was 14. And of course there was no electricity in those days in that village, no water except one outside tap for every four cottages and a stream running down the other side of the road. There was just a little post office, but there was no public house, there was no nothing.
Which village was this?
This was Longbridge.
Lombardy?
Longbridy, B-R-E-D-Y.
What job did you take up when you left school?
Well, this is the thing. I had the choice, the only choices open to me were to become a farm labourer in the area. I was au fait with all that because I was doing it before I went to school almost. I was quite a good horseman. And I can do anything on the farm as well, with the blacksmith. But there was no future, no prospect for youngsters there. The alternatives were to, my father could have got me probably into a riding stables as a stable boy, but we didn't, neither of us fancied that idea in those days. The alternative was to go to sea. And so he got me onto a training ship, the Warspite, in the Thames. Most of the lads on there were from orphanages. I was on that for a year till I was just turned 15, and then I got into the Navy on a training ship in Devonport.
When was that?
Well, that was 1920. I always stop and think about. So in 1924, I went to Devonport. I was accepted in as a boy in the Navy. I had to sign on for 5 years and 4 years. Reserve. I was on the impregnable there.
How did the Navy suit you?
Well, in some respects, I liked the discipline. I was quite athletic. I liked all that side of it. I was very fond of rowing, and we did a lot of it. I was in a racing cutter's crew and so on. But I didn't like the class question there, the officers versus the men. I didn't like it.
What about it specifically didn't you like?
Well, it was the attitude of the officers. You remember, this was the tail end of the old Navy, where the seamen were scum in the eyes of the officers, most of the officers. And even the general public at large, quite often, you know, This was the thing I disliked.
Can you give us any examples that occurred in your personal experience?
Well, not really. You know, it's difficult to pick out things. It was just the combination of things, the whole attitude. I liked the work. I liked being on the ship. I loved learning all the things there were to learn. And by the time I was 16, I could pass examinations as an able seaman, able-bodied seaman. I'd gone into navigation, gunnery, seamanship, all angles. But of course, you could only become an ordinary seaman when you were 18. And then you had to have 3 years before you could become an able seaman. And you had to pass your tests then, at the end of that time, to be an able seaman. Well, this was pure waste, I felt. You know, slogging around, and there was no future in that, as far as I was concerned. Exactly.
But coming back to the officers, did you feel slighted by them?
Oh, yes. Some of the attitude of some of them, and they were, most of them were from Dartmouth and places like that. There were some, and I can give you an example of one, who changed things for me quite a lot. And that was a lieutenant commander, gunnery officer, on HMS Emperor of India.
Who was he?
He was a lieutenant commander, Webb. And he'd been actually promoted from the lower deck. But he was a thoroughly nice chap. And I was allotted as his runner on board when we were on watch. And he was very thoughtful and considerate to us youngsters that did that job on watches with him. And he got me entered into a rifle and revolver competition in Devonport, fortnight's competition. I went into that and I won a second class aggregate silver medal overall, and I won one or two of the individual things. And so Commander Webb said he would get me to Bisley. And which of course I was quite keen on. But then in the end of 26, we had word, or Commander Webb told me, that there was a ship, HMS Renown, that was being refitted in Portsmouth to take the Duke and Duchess of York of the time round the world, particularly to Australia, to open Canberra as the capital of Australia. And they were going to make the complement, ship's complement, up from the three depots. That's Devonport, Portsmouth and Chatham. And they would be all selected people. So Lieutenant Webb asked me if I'd like to go. What would I think of it? Well, of course, I jumped at the idea, although I didn't think that I would ever get. He said, well, I'm going to recommend you. He recommended me, and I was accepted. So I moved down to Portsmouth, went on board. We then went up to Rosyth, where we finished certain aspects of the refit and did some manoeuvres up there with the repulse and the hood and the some of the 3rd Battle Squadron. And we came back to Portsmouth, and then we set off in 27. It was, we set off for this tour around the world via Panama and all islands that we had any influence on, right the way through to finally to New Zealand. Went all around New Zealand, every port, and stayed there for 3 weeks, I think it was, together. And then we came down the coast, the east coast of Australia, and then across to Tasmania, and back to Melbourne, and then finally from Melbourne across the Bight to Fremantle, and from there we were to proceed back home. And of course in the meantime the Duke and Duchess opened Canberra, and we were treated very well by all the Australian people, you know, the crew were as well. But combination of I wasn't keen on the idea of when we got back, going back to England, to the Navy, and things seemed wide open, so I actually deserted in Fremantle with a friend of mine. We stayed off, we missed the ship, we stayed there, and
Which year was this?
That was in 27. And we went out into the bush. We got some civilians, a few bits of civilian clothing on board before we went ashore. And we went out into the bush and we started walking and finally found ourselves jobs working in... I got a job as a team driver in the wheat belt. And you know, I was doing all sorts of things, timber felling and sheep shearing, and for until 1930. But I was an illegal immigrant. I had no papers, nothing. And yet I had no trouble from anybody. Nobody ever attempted to. So a lot of people must have known, realized that I was an Englishman, and I couldn't say how I got there, really. But nevertheless, I was completely free. And I enjoyed that, the excitement of it, the seeing a new country and being able to do different things, because I was always highly interested in all kinds of skills.
Did your parents know where you were?
Oh, yes. Yes, I wrote to them, you see, and told them. They were upset, of course, my father was. And they had taken then, he'd left that manager's job and taken a small public house near Basingstoke. He was a bit upset about it all, but I wrote to them regularly. And then, of course, I got a letter finally in 1930 from my mother to say that my father had died. And wouldn't I come home? Now, I first tried to see if there was any way I could get onto a ship to work my passage home.
Had you assumed a false name in Australia?
No, no. I could have done, because by just dropping off the White, because my name is Richard Kennedy White. I could have just easily have discarded the White, but I didn't bother with it. I kept my name. Failing to get anything like a job on a boat to come home, I must go back. In 1929, I had gone back to East Australia, to Melbourne, from Western Australia overland by train, because I had some friends there in Melbourne. I went over there and things were rather bad in Melbourne, employment-wise. I tried getting jobs, a salesman for a waterless cooker or things like that, which of course was hopeless. And I got on a little gang timber felling out at Kyneton. cutting green wattle for charcoal burning. And I worked with a harvesting gang travelling around thrashing for a while. But on this green wattle cutting, I was walking 4 miles to work every morning. We were living with a chap that had the contract, and his wife and 2 children in a little, what we called a humpy. It's just like a little shed, really. And a fireplace, open fireplace. And we all slept on the floor in the 2 divided rooms. And we lived very roughly, very poorly. And we had to tramp from there 4 miles every morning with this elderly man, he was 60 years of age, and I, to where the green wattle was. And then we were swinging our axes all day. And we got so much accord for what we cut, lopped, and stacked. And you had to work like slaves to make money in temperatures of 100, up to 110 in the shade. And one day I made a miscalculation, sweating my eyes and one thing and another, and the axe glanced off the face that I was cutting into the trunk, came down and pinned my left foot to the ground, the instep. I was finally, my compatriot, he managed to walk about 3 miles away to a road and stop a truck. And then they came and helped me onto this truck and took me to the doctor, and then I went to Kyneton Hospital. And I was there for about nearly 3 months in Kyneton Hospital. And it was then, after then, that I had this letter from mother about coming back home, because I had no money. So I finally went to the immigration people and asked if I could get a passport or get a paper that, you know, to enable me to travel to go back to England. And these friends of mine had offered to pay my fare home if I could do that. They said, of course, impossible. I had to explain exactly the situation to them. They said, well, they couldn't do anything. But they referred me to Mr. Glass, secretary of the Admiralty Department in Melbourne, Australia, Australian Navy. And I went and saw him and told him the story.
The truth?
Yes, of course. I mean, what else could I do? And he said, well, there were 60 who deserted that boat altogether, that trip. And I and my friend, who was still in Western Australia, were the only 2 that hadn't been recovered. And he said, well, if we take you, you won't go back to England. We'll send you to Flinders Base. You'll do 90 days detention. You'll have to be refitted, and then you'll be sent out to the China station for 2.5 years. And you would have to pay the cost of all the refitting and everything else and so on and so forth. Then, of course, by that time, I would be too old, because I was coming up to 18. So I'd be too old to be an ordinary seaman. If they made me an ordinary seaman after I'd done my detention, I'd be too old to get back into training to become an able seaman. And if I didn't pass the examination, if I just refused to pass the examination, well, I'd be ejected from the Navy then. He said, your alternatives are, he said, I'm going to look up, see what the records say now. But if I have to take you, you have the option of letting me do that. Or you walk out of here and we've never seen each other. I said, fair enough. So he went, checked, came back. He said, well, look, Mr. White, he said, we've had no further orders since the end of 1928 about what we should do. So he said, as far as I'm concerned, that's it. Of course, there was no love lost between the Australian Admiralty and the British Admiralty, to whom they were to some extent subservient, because it was a joint thing in many ways. And so therefore he went out of his way to help me for some reason. And so he finally gave me a letter, which I have still a copy of it, which simply stated that I was boy first class, such a number, so forth, deserted from HMS Renown, was not to be claimed for further service in His Majesty's forces. Signed, Mr. Glass. He said, well, that's, there it is. So you're all right. And I said, I must have something for the immigration people in writing. That before he gave me that. So he gave me that letter. And I went back to the immigration passport office, showed them the letter. So fair enough. Made me out a passport, and I had an Australian passport, on which my friends put up the money for me for the fare. Went on board Orient Liner, 5 weeks and 4 days, I think it was, journey back to England.
Which year did you leave Australia?
In 1930, just the beginning of 1930. That was the end of that.
What type of work did you take up on returning?
Well, of course, when I returned, I was started helping my mother, who was carrying on with the license of this small country pub. But it wasn't paying. I got a job in Thornycroft's Motor Works in Basingstoke, 7 miles away. I was cycling back and forth every day. But that lasted a few months. And then they had their rounds of redundancies, just put shoals of people off, and I was among them. By then my mother had to give up the license, and she moved to Basingstoke in a little house there, and I managed to get some odd jobs on the railway at the goods depot, but nothing much at all. Of course, the unemployment benefit was very, very low. I'm not quite sure if I remember what it was, somewhere in the nature of, I think it was something like about 17 shillings or something, but I'm not positive about that. However, I then got myself all kinds of jobs where I could. Worked on buildings as a labourer, as a scaffolder. I cleaned people's cars. I got fish down from Grimsby and ran it round on my bicycle to sell in the villages and try and make a few shillings and all kinds of things like that. Finally, my mother had a job as a house cook, living house cook, housekeeper for a family in Oxshott. And she was going to give that up to come to London to live with one of my sisters in London. And she suggested to her employers and to me that I take her job as a cook housekeeper, which we both accepted, and I became a cook housekeeper, cook general. I did that for possibly just over a year, I suppose, a year, coming up to 2 years, and I had my holiday. Went up to London, spent my fortnight's holiday at an agency that trained, did a course for butlers and parlour maids. I took a butler's course, and then I gave him my notice and got myself a job in London as a butler. Well, I had three jobs at that, and that was not my métier at all. Although I did the job, I could do it. And in 1934, my brother-in-law was working as a draftsman in the aluminium plant and vessel company, Putney. He got me a job as a fitter's mate labourer in that factory. So, of course, I left the